A, which is the toxicologic considerations of e-liquids and aerosols. And the first presentation that we'll have, you'll notice, is a little bit longer than some of the other ones that we've been having, but that's because we want a good overview of these toxicologic considerations. So we have for this Dr. Shane Gadd from Gadd Consulting Services to speak on toxicologic considerations. Again.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak for both my daughter and myself. And just to do the due diligence part, Gadd Consulting is a consulting company, the two of us and five other employees, that helps companies in developing new medical devices and drugs. E-liquids and such are really a bit outside of our area of practice. However, if you look at or consider e-cigarettes as delivery systems, and therefore as devices as they are regulated in Europe, then there is a lot of crossover. Samantha spoke earlier today on some parts of it. I'm going to speak mostly somewhat historically, okay? And I'm going to take advantage of the fact that as a late speaker, you inherit both disadvantages and advantages in a program. And what you try to do is to maximize the advantages and try to minimize the disadvantages. The disadvantages, of course, are that people that speak before you cover areas in your slides and areas in your planned talk that become duplicate. The advantage is that you have the opportunity to incorporate what's said before or reflect upon it. And while you can't in a perspective such as this or a program such as this modify your slides, you can add, as I'm now going to do, some commentary, and you struggle whether to put it at the end or the beginning, but I think the beginning is the appropriate place here. It should be clear that this talk is not going to be limited, obviously, to just e-liquids and aerosols, because it's also got to look at the interaction between the delivery system, the device, and there are interactions. And that's not been touched on much. Sam touched on it some. And it should also be obvious that from the talks you've had, and I have to say that over 40 years, I've been under different titles through this same process. As a new problem will become visualized, and as it's visualized, we have lots of people with lots of good ideas. I sometimes refer to what regulatory agencies, particularly the FDA, does as a science fair project at this point. And I mean that in a good way. I mean it in the way that we know we have a problem. We know we need to do something about it. It's a safety problem. But we don't really have sufficient definition of the problem or the use of the technology or how people may produce things in their basement and so forth, that we can set steadfast rules. So the approach is usually to essentially a launch an initiative, and in a sense this could be considered that initiative. The whole deeming process could be considered an initiative. To allow those that do have the resources and think in different ways to go forth and create the data and better allow you to then set regulations that really reflect and achieve the goals we want to. So it should be obvious to everybody here from this morning and this afternoon's date that we all come to this seeing things through different lenses. We have different experiences and different expertises that cause us to look at the problem, and as our last panel discussion said, displayed, see different things. Maybe not the same way. And I've been through that in several venues, as we're going to see. And forgive me, as you, being the senior, my glasses are not... Yes, senior is a nice term. I like that. Experienced or seasoned. We don't use the O word. Okay. Well, the perspective I'm going to offer you is from 40 years of working in the field of identifying and evaluating and assessing potential risk for products that have human use, largely drugs and devices. Okay. And I want to introduce a concept, to grow on a concept that you heard early this morning. We have these wonderful ideas. This is the e-cigarette, and people are going to use it this way and make it this way. And, of course, all that fits into when we're trying to, from our side, trying to make sure that we have a product which is foreseeably safe. We follow what's called the reasonable man hypothesis. And that is that we try to foresee how a reasonable and intelligent person is going to use a product and what the potential risk may be, or misuse. Samantha gave some examples this morning of obscure uses, different uses. But again, this is inherent in all these products. Once they're out of the control of the manufacturer and in the consumer's hands or in patients' hands or even in individual physicians' hands, okay, the use tends to become unusual, okay? So we have to try and foresee that. We talked about early, or you've heard people talk about, issues of this is a product you want to make, but issues of contamination. One of the things we're going to have to face with this set of products are simply a version of GMPs, good manufacturing practices, one way or another. Because contamination of product, we've all talked as if this is the e-liquid and it's going to be delivered this way and everything's fine, but contamination in the process of vendors supplying you the actual product, the device is delivering. That product itself is largely a natural product, so that inherently means there are going to be certain things in there, nitrosamines, and to a minor extent, dioxins, I have to say also. Those occur in all natural products. There are going to be manufacturing issues of contamination. The machinery that makes it tends to leave things on the product. And there are going to be issues of packaging contamination. We do, in the device land, we call this leachables, things that rub off onto product when it's manufactured. We always need to understand the concept that in toxicology, in safety assessment, we always need to set the qualification bar. This is, we can't say safe, but this is qualified and of acceptable conservative risk. And we need to set that starting in place of the worst case scenario. Okay? That our worst potential for our potential toxicity associated with a substance is what we have to assume, that population, that sensitive population we have to assume is there. Okay. But the king in all this is, and we're going to get to the main body of the talk here shortly, believe me, my daughter is my worst critic, and dose and data are the king. We've talked about models. You've heard people talk about modeling this and that, and that's all fine, but you've also by now should understand that a lot of our data is diffuse. We have models and not data, so we have to understand how the product's used, how the differences in manufacturing, and so forth. And now I want to start to move you towards make the shift to the main body or what toxicology is all about in evaluating these. And I want to point out that a lot of this is not new. There's a lot of prior art here. Okay? There's the prior art of inhalation toxicology, which 40 years ago, 30 years ago, I started out as what we called at the time a rat gasser, okay, was very widespread. Many laboratories had it. Many universities had inhalation centers. And it sort of went away, and now it's coming back. So, but we know a lot about how to generate atmospheres, how to measure them, and you've heard some of that today. Combustion toxicology. How many people here? Show of hands. Anybody here remember combustion toxicology? Oh, I am a senior. Well, back in the late 70s, early 80s, we had a great concern about fires on airplanes and homes and hotels. We had a lot of deaths that occurred because of that, and of extremely toxic substances that came out of the polymers and such, which had begun to replace woods and so forth in construction. Okay, and there was a national, at the time it was called NIST, National Institutes of Standards Institutes, that had a panel for some years that worked on that. And it came to, and this gets to the mixtures question that you heard talked about, it's not just nicotine, it's not just cotinine, it's not just tin or any of those other things. It's a combination of all those things that you're going to have exposure to. And the mixtures problem in combustion tox, which came out, and there we truly had combustion of some form or another as opposed to thermal, perhaps some thermal degradation as we have here in thermal generation. Excuse me. And Barbara Levin from NIST came up with the NGAS model, and the last version of the NGAS model for looking at combinations with the 9-gas model. I think that's at about that point. We sort of dissolved and went away and went our separate ways. And ingredients. There's a lot of prior art on ingredients that does spill over from tobacco, and ingredients in the sense of things that are added. Okay? And LSRO had a panel that generated a number of volumes of work on that. I recommend you may want to look at those when you're looking at ingredients. Okay. And next to last, before we go on, note that the generation temperature that you've heard about is not just a matter of changing what batteries or what current and what temperature. Doesn't just change the kinetics, the rate kinetics of generation. It also, just as it does when you're looking at stability and degradation of products in the pharmaceutical industry, it changes the reactions, and perhaps you get formaldehyde or other things that you didn't intend that weren't there to begin. So it's not just a matter of using that as a way of modifying what's produced in terms of quantity. And then finally, we had the nano effect. We had some reference to that. We've known nanos for certainly 40 years. Back in the days of combustion tox, one of the problems everybody dealt with was why was PTFE, polytetrafluoroethylene, so toxic when it burned? Okay? Because if you just did the gas on an inhalation study, the animal sat there and said, oh, less filling, tastes good. Not a problem. The issue was that on smokes, which are a form of aerosol, you would coat the particle with a high concentration of that PTFE, and you'd get deep lung penetration that you did not get if you just did the gas. Okay? So those particulates or aerosols, of course, everybody got to later on today got to referring to these as particulates. Those particulates or aerosols aren't just a matter of getting that that into the lung, but they may serve as a carrier to provide a hot spot to deal with the lungs. Okay, so that said, let's go forward. Oops, other way. Well, routes of exposure. Everybody here has talked, or to a large degree, we've talked as if the only routes of exposure that we're concerned about are respiratory, one form or another. But that's not true. Okay, there's respiratory, there's oral, the stuff that impacts the and gets swallowed inside of the mouth gets swallowed, it's mucosal. The tissue in the inside of the mouth, the lips, the very upper end of the respiratory tract. And finally, there's dermal. Not so much as there would be with regular cigarettes, but you will have dermal exposure because you are not everything that you when you drag on the e-cigarette, everything is going to end up going down and in. Some of it will end up having dermal exposure. Well, this gets to be our first problem. Somebody referred to it. Most of our available non-clinical, that is animal data, is from the oral route. And what we don't want to do is start a whole new program of using lots and lots of animals to generate lots more data. To the extent we can, we want to use prior art. Well, there is prior art data. The problem is that it's largely not by the route we're really interested in. Limited amounts of dermal data, limited amount, minimal inhalation data for many of the things we're working with. Okay, well, a complex issue on many grounds. I've talked briefly of routes, or I gave you an outline of the routes of exposure. And the best approach to any complex issue, the scientific method as we best know it, is to deconstruct the problem and start by understanding the prior art and how to use it and how it has limitations, therefore knowing what we need to go on. But don't reinvent the wheel. That's the big part of the message. Okay. Well, the sources of compounds for which there are potential toxic exposures from e-cigarettes, on the left-hand column, your sources, the external base of the e-cigarette, the delivery device. We had a meeting here with CDRH, a workshop about 3 months ago now, when we dealt with respiratory delivery system devices. And many of the considerations should spill over here. You generate something, it flows through the device and into the biologic system, into the patient or the consumer. And as it does so, it's going to interact with the components of that device. It's going to pick up some things in that device, particularly if the device is not single use, which e-cigarettes are not. Neither are most respiratory medical devices. Okay, so it's going to pick up stuff that's on the surface of that device, the gas pathway as it goes, and it's also to a degree going to do some extraction of materials out of what your device is constructed of, whether it's a polymer, whether it's ceramic, even a metal, or a fiber. Okay, so you also have the gas pathway components in the delivery system. You've got the product containing. There it is. Does work. Thank you. The product-containing portion of the delivery system, the reservoir, if you will, or the cartridge, and finally the product itself. And potential exposure routes, the table lays it out. Notice that categories 1 through 3, first 3 here, can best be considered from the perspective of a medical device and of the biomaterials and biocompatibility. And the models for assessing that in terms of extraction and so forth, cytotoxicity is a screen, for example, which I think the next 2 speakers are going to speak somewhat of. Really come out of the ISO. We've heard about ICH, International Conference for Harmonization. Well, that's mostly pharmaceuticals, though devices have largely moved in some ways towards ICH as a governing set of guidances of how we do things. ISO, International Standards Organization, and 10993, ISO 10993, TAC 1, it's in 20 parts, but TAC 1 is this wonderful table we'll see in a little bit. This is how you go about things. E-cigarettes in Europe are regulated as devices, so they took that approach. It's possible to consider materials as individual chemical moieties in these devices, and materials that make up the liquids, but there are leachable and extractable issues with this approach. Leachables and extractables, do not believe that just because it's a metal, it's going to be totally inert as things pass over it. Certainly not a ceramic, certainly not a polymer, etc. Okay, oops. And sources of compounds for which they're potentially potent, it should be patient exposures. There's my typo. Delivered product, category 4, on that table. There's your table. They're complex mixtures, so it's a mixture problem. In fact, your extractables and leachables to a degree are mixture also, but more so your product, particularly if you go beyond the paradigm of nicotine, propylene glycol, and glycerin. Okay, as you add other things in there, it's going to get more and more. And as you thermally degrade that in generating the system or stability issues or such, you're going to see more complex mixtures. The formulations are going to be varied, and that's part of the problem that we're going to have to deal with. It's an entrepreneurial opportunity to produce things that are attractive in different ways to different populations. We restrict that in the terms of traditional tobacco products. But it is something we're obviously going to have to consider as we go forward. And while this delivered material, is not combusted, this is not combustion toxicology, that is burned either with or without oxygen. It is subject to being vaporized. You have to have pyrolysis. Possible other reactions driven by heat and energy. Anytime you put energy into a chemical system, things are going to change. Okay? You have possible extraction from the delivery device components that are in contact with the product. It's most likely to have biological effects and to have dermal and surrounding individual exposures as things come out. Well, consider prior art, combustion toxicology. That effort was 1978 to 96. Hotels, homes, aircraft fires, as we began to recognize, just as we did with medical devices earlier than that. Medical devices started, people referred to the USP. Well, the USP, of course, is really drugs and device. The original guidance as to device testing and biocompatibility comes from the USP, but it didn't call it devices. It still doesn't. It calls it medical closures. And what happened is we went from glass, when you got your drug from the pharmacist, you used to the doctor, you used to get in a glass container. Nobody sees glass much anymore. Your intravenous administration came from glass bottles. It's all out of polymers and such. So the concern came, what comes out of that? Well, the same is here with e-cigarettes. The NISIC combination pattern, Einhorn with a fellow out in Utah that discovered and briefly characterized a super toxicant that was generated by fires. It turned out, not really. It had to be very special conditions. And there's some more stuff on combustion tox. You can refer to that at your leisure. The complexity of the inhaled materials that someone using an e-cigarette is going to have, several physical forms. And you're going to have phase changes if you have physical chemistry. You have aerosols. You have a solution that may be vaporized into a gas. The gas may, or it may be, in fact, go to an aerosol. The aerosol particles are going to coalesce. And as it goes through the body, and from the pharmaceutical side, from drug land, we're aware of this, as it goes through the body into that respiratory tree, it's going to be modified depending on its interaction with the physical chemical nature of the tissues. It's impacting on tissues. It's not all about impaction. Is it water soluble? Is it lipid soluble? Is it going to aggregate? Okay, all sorts of concerns. So, solutions and suspensions that are generated, dry powder particulates to some degree, depending if you have some of the potential things that can be added to these to the product, the e-liquid product. You're going to have some true particulates as opposed to aerosols, liquid aerosols, vapors and gases. Okay, very different things. Well, complexity of exposure profile for inhalation for inhaled materials. You're going to have varied exposure populations. I purposely excluded, if we were talking drugs or we were talking medical devices, we'd have pediatric in here. We don't, but we do have geriatric, and we do have people who have respiratory compromise. Okay, very different population than a normal, healthy population. site for potential effects, they could be, all of these things could be affecting the body, either systemically, they get absorbed and they do something somewhere else, or they could be locally acting. We're going to look at that in a little bit more detail also as we go by here. The site of delivery. And this is for actual inhaled material, the lungs, the nasal passages, the throat. And as I said, the delivery spectrum is based on physical, chemical factors. Okay? There are a range of guidance documents, starting with the PQRI that Samantha referred to earlier, for oral inhalation nasal drug products, leachables and extractables at the top, and then going down from there. So there's a fair amount of guidance out there for respiratory drugs and devices that we ought to take advantage of when we look at. And guidances just tell you if this is things you ought to think about or approaches. Okay? Well, the respiratory system. Let's focus on, get away from the oral. Let's go to the major case. The major case is respiratory, respiratory pulmonary. And people sometimes lose sight of the fact that the respiratory system is really one of three major portals into the body. Okay? The skin, the GI tract, the respiratory system. That's how things are going to get into the body. It has the least effective barrier aspect of these three systems. The skin is the most effective. The GI tract, second to that, but the respiratory tree less. And it also has, however, just like the other two, enhanced metabolic and immunologic functions. And I haven't heard anybody talk about immune responses in terms of inhaled, in terms of some of the products here, so we need to keep in mind that. And it leads to complexity of potential exposures. We need to consider local tissue tolerance, irritation, perhaps corrosion, systemic toxicity. If it gets absorbed and gets taken to the body, what's it do? And then allergenicity or evoking immune response. Okay? Complex analytical methods are currently available. Well, this is a place where I'm going to say you've already heard about this, so I don't have to cover it. It buys me back some of the time I spent at the very beginning. There's a lot of prior art here in generating atmospheres and in measuring them, and should pay attention to the prior art. The technology has advanced greatly from when it was just cascade impactors. And you heard about aerodynamic particle size. It's not just about the size of the particle, but also about the density. We assume, by and large, unit density. It's like water, water droplets. And maybe it is. But if there's metal particulates in there, if there is, in fact, 10 that enters that system or other particles that are left behind, metal particles that are left behind in as manufacturing contaminants, then they're going to have a very different density and they're going to behave differently in the respiratory tree. Okay? So your data generation for ONI, oral inhalation and nasal moieties, is challenging due to the complexity of both the moieties and the testing methods. Has to be well thought out before you launch into an inhalation program. There's a reason that it was very specialized, that they tend to be, as our technology advances, very much more expensive. And simply use the ICH QVD approaches for analytical methods to increase the assurance of the quality of your testing. Okay, well, needed in descending order of desirability when we start to talk about using prior art, well-characterized inhalation exposure data. That should be our gold standard. If we're worried about respiratory and pulmonary effects, yes, it's important. Also remember, it's impacting the respiratory tree as it goes along, so you're going to have local tissue mucosal effects. But inhalation systemic, inhalation toxicology data, moderately characterized. Not quite GLP, maybe it's older, maybe it goes back to the 40s. There is good data back from the 40s and such, but it's harder and harder to find. Moderately characterized inhalation data. Parenteral and mucosal exposure data would be your next choice. Okay, either it was given parenterally, IV, sub-Q, whatever, or it was you had mucosal data, muscle and so forth and so on. Oral data. Go for oral. And finally, dermal. Dermal is about the bottom of the list in terms of systemic because the issues of characterizing, especially for a mixture, differential absorption systemically is fairly complex. And that's based on the relative barrier function. Remember, I talked about three major portals, dermal, greater barrier function than oral, oral greater barrier function than respiratory. And what we want to understand here is if we're using one to the other, oral data to try and give us an understanding of what will happen in elation, the margin of exposure, okay? How much of how well absorbed is the material by a different route? How different is the metabolism? How different is the inhalation? Or the immunologic response, but more importantly, how different is the degree of systemic absorption and exposure and the hazard quotient between them. If you've done this long enough, like I said, I go back 40 years on this, if you've done it long enough, inhalation parenteral IV, typically your systemic exposure levels that have toxicity are much lower than if you do, certainly if you do dermal. The result of all this, or the end result, needs to be an integrated assessment, not just a PDE. I'll introduce the concept from pharmaceuticals is a permissible daily exposure for material, and we can do PDEs for many of these things. You heard reference to the USP listings of monographs. Well, there's a lot of data out there. The USP for excipients and actives. Those are only for approved ones in pharmaceuticals, and unfortunately, I think you're going to find that a lot of the things that we run into that we're concerned about here aren't really present in that data set. Based on quantitative lethal dose or toxic dose data, okay, usually we're more concerned. We really don't want any lethality. So we've got to add some sort of safety factors to get us from lethal dose data. And now lethal dose data by a different route, more safety factors. Different population, we have rat data or mouse data, and we're worried about people. We're not really worried about the rats using e-cigarettes. And then we also have to consider genotoxicity, sensitization, irritation, and specific responses to the respiratory system. Okay, so this is comparative absorption factors. It's a nice table I put together for routes that include nasal that apply here. Try again. Yes. Delivery interface to the blood, oral, IV, et cetera, you go across. So there's lots of data on that. My understanding is the slides were, no, they're not available. Okay. Well, then, certainly anybody that wants them, feel free, and we'll send you a slide set. It's just what you do, okay? Well, schematic depiction of the respiratory system, very complex, many different cell types. The structure can be altered by disease state, okay? Long-term smokers, anyone? And exposure to gases and particulates, aerosols, can occur throughout the entire respiratory tree or tract. Okay? Starting with that oral exposure, that mucosal exposure, the oral pharynx. Okay? All the way down into, and there's some very nice work coming out of Lovelace and other places, in terms of deep lung penetration and characterizing it and what happens with particulates and ways of measuring these things. And we've got new technology that allows us to essentially tag particles or things and see where they go. Okay? Branching structure, typically the respiratory tree branches two by two by two by two until you get all the way to the bottom. And as you see, when you start to get down to these are called generations or daughter generations levels of branching. And if you get all the way down, oops, it decided it doesn't like me as that. Now we'll try again. Okay, if you get down to the alveolar sacs, the air velocity, as you see, goes, and you heard reference to this, really goes to zero. It becomes a sedimentation Above that, however, realize that's not every particle. That's not everything. Because it begins, remember that mass median diameter. Okay? The denser it is, the deeper it's going to go. Also, remember that it, as you go deeper and deeper into the lungs, you've got a more humidified atmosphere. You have more chance, in fact, of the surface tissues in and of themselves absorbing out of a gas stream. Okay? Much more complex issue. Clearance, the important functions of the lungs, I should say that, and I've got the time, so conducts air, obviously. It detoxifies the air and filters it. Produces proteins. Lots of proteins produced down here. Produces mucus. Clears the lungs. The lungs are not only had a very minimal barrier system, but it's enhanced by that surfactant mucus layer that floats on the top deep in the lungs, and it has its own clearance system. Okay? And has a lot of metabolic functions. We'll briefly look at that. The air is conditioned as it gets in the lungs. It becomes more humidified, warmer, gets filtered, and there is some barrier function in the deep lungs. And you've seen this slide before, so I won't dwell on it. Here you are, exposure, and again, if you're interested in the slides, I'll be glad to share them. Exposure to gases and vapors as we go from the nasal cavity through the larynx, the trachea, all the way to the lungs, and then assumedly into the bloodstream if it gets absorbed. Notice that water solubility is a critical factor in determining the depth to which a gas or an aerosol penetrates into the lungs. Okay? And that similar principles apply for vapors. Chemical reactivity is a factor in deep lung penetration. And that the metabolic capacity of the local epithelium can be important. Okay? Aerosols. People have talked as if these were all dust, particles is the term that's been used, and they're not. And in fact, most of the aerosols we have here, we will pick up some metals. We talked about that. That's the device part. We will pick up some particulates as the gas, if you will, passes across surfaces of the delivery system. But by and large, these aerosols are going to be liquid droplets or droplets that coalesce or aggregate, changing as they go on. Okay? At the same time, they may actually, it may not be all a matter of size, a matter of these particles growing, as you were, by aggravation. They may also be reduced in size as there's some impact to absorption or is there some change in the phase as you go deeper and deeper, phase shift phenomena. Okay, particle factors that influence, that's not going to work. Okay. Inhalation of aerosols lead to deposition of aerosol particles or droplets in the respiratory tract. Particle factors influencing deposition, the particle size, shape, other properties. And you've essentially seen a version of this also. Factors influencing deposition. Size is part of it. Presentations in terms of particle size distributions as they occur. It's going to be different, here where it's not largely solid particles. Okay. Mechanisms for deposition, particle deposition or droplet deposition. Interception occurs when the trajectory hits the wall. Impaction, sedimentation, diffusion. Okay. You've seen this slide before also. It was not original to the Nature drug discovery, by the way. It's been around for a long time. Metabolic capabilities of the respiratory system components. Obviously, there's lots of fruit here to be picked, but it's a very complex metabolic system. Okay? You've got the alveolar macrophages that are somewhat unique to the respiratory system, and yet we see a bit of foreign body, and you can consider what happens systemically with foreign body responses to implants and so in device land. Okay? Particle clearance, mechanism exists for clearing particles that impact from the surface. Now notice, if it's a liquid, if they're liquid droplets or such, or they're vapors, they're not going to be particles, and the macrophages are not going to be very useful in terms of clearing anything. Okay? And I think we've seen this slide before. And important types of respiratory tract epithelium, different types of tissue. They change, notice, as you go deeper and deeper into the lungs. The function, total lung, the whole thing about respiratory function is significantly more complex. And I'm running out of time, so Samantha was right, as usual. So I want you to note, however, acute respiratory responses, oxidative burden, reactive oxygen species. Okay, nope. There we go. Release of mediators of lung toxicity, acute reactions. Again, you've got local tissue tolerance, you've got systemic toxicity, you've got immune-mediated responses, pulmonary edema. Oops. Okay. It's not working anymore.
I think that's a hint.
Okay. Okay. And I'm sorry I, in fact, didn't get to the last of it, but the remaining parts have to do with accessing data that's out there. There's a lot of prior art in toxicology. There's a lot of approaches to using it. Thank you. I should have told you that.
Thank you, and maybe we can pick up some of those points with the panel discussion too. About the question of slides being available, the slides, if we have to post them online, there's restrictions on that, so therefore the slides themselves are not on, but this is recorded and this recording of the presentation. So if you want to see the slides again or the presentation, they will be online. The next speaker is Dr. Robert Leverett from Lorillard Tobacco Company, speaking on comparison of the in vitro toxicity profiles of e-cigarettes, tobacco burning cigarettes, smokeless tobacco, and nicotine replacement therapy. Dr. Leverett?
Good afternoon. I'm Robert Leverett from Lorillard Tobacco Company, and I'm going to be talking about an internal study that we did at Lorillard. So let me just get that clear. I am an employee of Lorillard Tobacco Company, and Lorillard Inc. owns Lorillard Tobacco Company and Blue e-cigs, and it's the Blue e-cigs that we used in this study. So just a quick rundown outline of the talk, give a little bit of background information, the products and samples that we used, how we prepared the samples for testing, the exposures, the methods that we used, the results, the general summary, and then some thoughts on future testing that we plan on doing. Background, this was a preclinical, non-clinical tox assessment of electronic cigarettes, specifically just utilizing four in vitro tests, typically used for screening, that we have used for screening for tobacco burning cigarettes. We wanted to use multiple endpoints because we wanted to have more of a weight of evidence approach for evaluating the biological impact associated with e-cigs. And we decided we wanted to utilize appropriate comparative product types. We wanted to compare the e-cigarettes to typical tobacco burning cigarettes as well as other nicotine delivery products, typically smokeless and a nicotine replacement therapy product. This is just a diagram of the product that we used. Again, I mentioned we used Blue e-cigarettes. These were the two prominent market-leading flavors at the time, the Magnificent Menthol and Classic Tobacco. We used two different nicotine levels. We had 0 or 2.4% nicotine. We also used an e-cig vehicle control. We had just a glycerol water e-cigarette as well. We used three tobacco burning cigarettes, two Kentucky reference cigarettes, a 3R4F and a 1R5F, excuse me, as well as the market cigarette, the Marlboro Gold. We used a Nicorette gum, a 4-milligram nicotine product, and two smokeless tobacco products, a Marlboro Snus, as well as a Copenhagen Snuff. We produced samples from these products. The e-cigarettes, we looked at the e-liquids themselves. We also did a pad-collected aerosol, and we also did whole aerosol exposures. For the tobacco-burning cigarettes, we used pad-collected smoke as well as whole smoke. And for the NRTs and SLTs, we just developed or created an aqueous extract from these products for testing. Simple sample preparation. From the blue e-cigarettes, we basically just pulled out the wicking material, transferred that to a syringe, and squeezed out the liquid for testing. For the aqueous extracts, we basically just made a suspension at 80 milligrams per ml, incubated at 37 degrees for 24 hours with shaking. We took that extract and filter sterilized it and used that for testing in our assays. For pad collected smoke aerosol, we used the Health Canada intense smoking regime because we used that for producing collecting smoke from tobacco burning cigarettes. We just wanted to do a side-by-side comparison, and since there is no standard or set protocol for smoking regime for e-cigarettes, we decided to do that, and I'm going to stop since that's been discussed quite extensively today. Again, we just collected the smoke or the aerosol in a pad and extracted it in DMSO to produce a stock solution at 40 mg per ml. For whole smoke and whole aerosol exposures, we used the Vitrocell VC10 smoking robot and the aerosol or smoke delivery and dilution system so we can expose cells directly to diluted smoke or aerosol. The assays we used, again, were typically applied to evaluate tobacco smoke toxicity. We used the neutral red uptake assay for cytotoxicity. Mutagenesis was the Ames assay. Looked at in vitro micronuclei formation, and we looked at inflammation using an IL-8 cytokine release assay. And some of these do have a high concordance with in vivo, specifically when the Ames assay and the in vitro micronucleus assay are taken in conjunction with each other. You tend to see approximately a 73% concordance with rodent carcinogens and a 78% concordance with in vivo genotoxins. This is just a brief outline of the approaches and the methods that we used. Cytotoxicity and IL-8, we used A549 cells, which is a human lung epithelial carcinoma cell line, in 96 well plates. In the mutation assay, we looked at two strains, TA98 and TA100, with metabolic activation, and we used the pre-incubation assay. For micronucleus formation, we use Chinese hamster ovary cells. We use these cells because we use a high-content approach for an automated micronucleus assay, and that assay has been optimized for Chinese hamster ovary cells. And again, that was a 96-well plate format. When we did our whole smoke or whole aerosol, there were some changes in the method, just outlined here. Specifically for cytotoxicity and mutation assays and inflammation, we used 35 millimeter plates. We had to increase the cell density. And we exposed for IL-8 and neutral red whole smoke from 5 cigarettes or aerosol from 200 puffs from an e-cigarette. In the mutation assay, again, we had direct exposure with the bacteria and the S9 on the plate to whole smoke from 3 cigarettes or aerosol e-cigarette aerosol from 200 puffs. We are still developing a whole smoke, whole aerosol micronucleus assay for in vitro. This is a table of the dose ranges that we used in our assays. The dose ranges varied dependent upon the assay, dependent upon the type of sample that was being tested. And the reason why is for each assay and for each sample, there are sample solubility limitations in the media. There are assay-specific sample volume limitations. You know, we couldn't add too much sample without diluting the system or affecting the system. And for example, there are solvent limitations for DMSO, because if you increase the level of DMSO to a point, you're going to start seeing DMSO effects. So that's the reason why there are differences in the dose ranges that we used. And some may think, well, how do these doses relate to what a human could potentially be exposed to? And this is just a very simplistic, very crude calculation. If we do some assumptions and looking at maybe an 18 milligram of tar per cigarette, a person smoking one pack of 20 cigarettes would deliver approximately 360 milligrams of tar. assuming 100% retention in the lung and estimate the lung tissue volume at 950 mLs, you're going to get 0.38 megs of tar per mL. If we look at electronic cigarette, doing a similar usage comparison, maybe 200 puffs a day, again, we're assuming 1.5 milligrams of aerosol per puff, so that would give us about 300 milligrams of aerosol. Again, assuming 100% retention in the lung, a 950 mL volume, you're going to get 0.32 milligrams of aerosol per mL. The experimental doses for the conventional cigarettes range from 0 to 0.5. The electronic cigarettes range from 0 to 48 megs per mL. So you see the in vitro doses range from 1.3 to 150-fold higher than this very simplistic and crude calculation. So let's go into the assays. Here we have the cytotoxicity, which represents cell death. This is the ability to uptake a dye by live or healthier cells. So higher values indicate lower cytotoxicity in the sense that it takes more to kill the cells. Here is a graph representing the results for the e-liquids, the SLT, and NRT extracts. We have, if I could have the pointer. There it is. We have percent vehicle control in increasing doses. 100% represents no cytotoxicity. All the e-cigarettes as well as the SLT and NRT extracts show no indication of cytotoxicity at the doses tested. When we move to the pack collected smoke and aerosol, you can see over here, again, percent vehicle control. We have the typical tobacco, conventional tobacco burning cigarettes show high levels of cytotoxicity at lower doses, while the electronic cigarettes are showing no indication of cytotoxicity at the doses tested. We can calculate an EC50 for the conventional cigarettes, roughly about 0.2 mgs per mL, but we can't calculate an EC50 for the e-cigarettes since there was no indication of cytotoxicity at the doses tested. When we look at whole smoke, again, we see cytotoxicity induced by the conventional tobacco burning cigarettes and no indication of cytotoxicity from the aerosols produced from the e-cigarettes. Again, we can calculate an EC50 for the conventional cigarettes, and again, roughly it's about 0.2 mgs per mL. When we look at the mutagenesis assay, we're looking at a genotoxicity event mutation. We're looking at point mutations with TA100 and frameshift type mutations with TA98. Here's a graph pulling all the data together. Again, here we have the pad collected smoke aerosol from the tobacco burning cigarettes showing a high level of activity. While the e-liquids are bouncing right around background levels, the aqueous extract of the SLTs and NRTs, again, are bouncing around background levels, and the pack collected aerosols from the e-cigarettes, again, are showing very little and just basically background levels of activity. When we look at the whole smoke and aerosol mutagenicity, again, for the tobacco burning cigarettes, we see a considerable amount of activity at revertance per milligram. But the e-cigarette aerosols that were delivered, again, are producing very low to no activity and, again, bouncing around background levels. Looking at inflammation. For inflammation, we look at IL-8 release. This is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, and it's produced by several cell types, including epithelial cells. Again, we're looking at the ability for IL-8 to be released in the culture media, and higher values indicate a higher inflammatory response. These are the results for the e-liquids, SLT, and NRT extracts. Again, we're seeing for the SLT and NRT extracts, we're not seeing any activity. We do see some slight induction of IL-8 for some of the e-cigarettes, but not all of them, at these doses that are tested. And these would be considerably high doses when we compare it to a typical conventional cigarette. When we look at the IL-8 release from the pad collected smoke and aerosols, again, we're seeing considerable IL-8 release by the conventional cigarettes, but we're not seeing any release, IL-8 release from the aerosols produced by the e-cigarettes at these doses. For the whole smoke and aerosol and whole aerosol for the inflammation, again, we're not seeing any indication of IL-8 release from the vapors or the aerosol produced by the e-cigarettes, but we are seeing increase in IL-8 release from those from the smoke from the tobacco burning cigarettes. The micronuclei formation, this represents a clastogenetic effect. In other words, your breakage of chromosomes. And again, higher values indicate higher MN formation. Here's the results for e-liquids, the SLT and NRT extracts. Again, looking at percent vehicle control, 100% would indicate no activity. We're not seeing any indication of MN formation of the from the e-cigarette liquids and the SLT-NRT extracts at the doses tested. Now, we also looked at cytotoxicity down here for in CHO cells, and again, we're not seeing any indication of cytotoxicity from these samples on the CHO cells at the doses tested. When we looked at pad-collected smoke and aerosol, for the e-cigarettes, we're not seeing any indication of MN formation, but we do see a dose-dependent increase in MN formation from the tobacco-burning cigarettes. Also, what we see is we don't see any indication of cytotoxicity in the CHO cells from the pad-collected aerosols, but we start to see cytotoxicity being induced from the pad-collected smoke. So in conclusion, from this internal study, we have successfully adapted tobacco-burning cigarette whole smoke exposure equipment and methods for use in electronic cigarette aerosol in vitro tox screening. We saw for the electronic cigarettes in the liquids and the aerosols, as well as the aqueous extracts from the SLT and NRT products tested in this study, we didn't see any meaningful toxic effect measured by these four endpoints under the experimental conditions typically utilized in the evaluation of tobacco-burning cigarettes. We did see that slight induction of IL-8 for some of the e-cigarettes, but that induction was diminished or lost upon the aerosol upon exposure of the aerosol to the cells. So these results suggest that there is potential for electronic cigarettes to significantly reduce the tox impact when compared to tobacco-burning cigarettes. But where do we go from here? This is what we think, what Lorillard would like to do. We need to consider what to test. I think that's also been quite discussed today from the panel discussions, et cetera. We need to test the liquids. We need to test the flavors and the vehicles, the solvents, et cetera. And I think that's an important factor. But some of the results that we saw with a little bit of IL-8 induction for the liquid, but no IL-8 induction for the aerosol, we need to study, of course, the electronic cigarette aerosols. And we need to do that in a way the aerosols are generated as intended for use. Again, the argument for how do we smoke these things on machines to do these in vitro exposures. Unfortunately, when you're trying to do aerosol exposures, you do increase the complexity related to equipment, the exposure methods, and also dosimetry. I think we've shown here it's useful to compare e-liquids and aerosol results to those from traditional tobacco-burning cigarettes. It gives us a baseline of comparison as to how these e-cigarettes are behaving or how they affect the in vitro systems when compared to a tobacco-burning cigarette. Again, looking at pad-collected smoke condensates, as we have historically done, or even looking at whole smoke and comparing that with whole aerosol. How to test? And again, this is just strictly in vitro. Very simplistic screening assays like we've shown here. Just do monocell culture, looking at a single cell type, A549, which has historically been used, which unfortunately it is an epithelial carcinoma cell line. It is transformed. However, using normal bronchial epithelial cell lines like B2B or NHBE would be also of use. Looking at cold culture methods, again, looking at more than one cell type grown in combined culture. And this is useful in studying cell interactions and signaling between cell types. So we could get a handle on how these electronic cigarettes and their vapors or aerosols might interact with the cell signaling or these cell-to-cell interactions. Going a step further to the 3D organotypic cell culture systems, like Mucilair or Epi Airway, commercially available systems, would be most useful because these are more representative of lung tissue. So going down this list, going from the mono to the cold culture to these 3D organic cell culture systems, it's increasing in complexity. However, it does increase relevancy in the system that you're using to study the tox effects. To throw another wrench into the works, all these tests that I've shown here, they're acute. They've only been exposed for upwards of 24 hours. However, it's also been discussed today, we need to understand what the chronic exposures would be. And again, that's going to increase the complexity of the cell culture methods in order to be able to expose cells over days and weeks versus just hours. What endpoints should we consider? Well, simple screening using the monocultures like I've shown here today, looking at the cytotoxicity, mutagenicity, or other genotoxicity endpoints. They're a good start, but it's just a start. It's not end-all, be-all. We can look at pathways and adverse effects. We can look at cell proliferation, cell stress, inflammation. Again, we looked at one marker of inflammation, IL-8. However, a more extensive examination using cytokine panels to look at a more broad spectrum of inflammatory markers would be appropriate. Metabolomics, looking at how e-cigarettes could perturb just the natural metabolic processes in a cell. Going even a step further, go to disease biomarkers. Look at cell transformation or biomarker panels specific for diseases like COPD, cardiovascular, or cancer. Again, this is not an end-all be-all for in vitro, and it's clear that we're going to have to continue on looking at in vivo methods as well as human clinical trials to get a good understanding about electronic cigarettes. Again, going down this list, you're increasing complexity and you're increasing relevancy as you go down this list. And with that, that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Rachel Behar from the University of California, Riverside, and she will be speaking about in vitro model to evaluate cytotoxicity.
Okay, actually, my title today is Identification of Toxicants in Cinnamon-Flavored Electronic Cigarette Refill Fluids, and I just want to start with, I have no conflict of interest, and my work has been supported by grants funded to my PI, Dr. Prue Talbot, from TRDRP as well as NIH, and I have been fortunate enough to be personally supported by UCR grants, TRDRP, as well as NIH. So for my studies, I've taken an in vitro approach as well to evaluate electronic cigarette cytotoxicity, and I'd just like to discuss quickly the advantages and limitations that we feel pertain to in vitro systems. So using in vitro systems, you can quickly screen large numbers of samples over a range of doses. It's definitely less expensive. You can utilize human cells. There's no sacrificing of animals. There's many advancements made in modeling organs, one example being air-liquid interface. You can incorporate metabolism assays to your experimental design. Multiple cell types can be cross-compared, as we've seen in the previous talk. It also allows for pre-screening to be able to generate maybe a more valid experimental design for your in vivo or clinical trials. And also, something that I don't think has been touched today, it also allows for a prenatal human development model. Many women who are current smokers that become pregnant continue to smoke, and one thing that they might be using as an alternative would be electronic cigarettes. So knowing how electronic cigarettes are affecting developing embryos, I think, is an important point. And there's certainly a limitation being that these results, of course, have to be confirmed in humans or in vivo studies. So the purpose of my talk then is refill fluids, and we've gone over this a little bit, but a current paper earlier this year found that there were over 7,000 unique flavors with more than 200 new flavors per month. And these fluids contain nicotine that ranges from 0 to 36 milligrams per mil. Flavorings, we've already heard two fun flavors, cotton candy and cake. But I have a few favorites of my own, chocolate-covered bacon, gummy bear, and roast chicken. But there are, of course, traditional flavors such as tobacco and menthol. And these foods also contain humectants, of course, propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, glycerol, or a combination of these. So I'd like to discuss the rationale for testing refill fluids directly on cells. The refill fluids themselves may be toxic. Users and bystanders inhale volatile organic compounds coming off of these fluids. And in fact, as you see here in the corner, I have no mouse. You see in the corner, this is one of our lab members who, upon first handling these fluids, became ill and since then has required a respirator for using these. And I myself get sometimes very nauseous after long-term exposure using these under the hood. The fluid, as Samantha touched on, is drawn into the user's mouth very commonly. Many users say that this happens to them while puffing. And the fluid itself can be absorbed through the skin when handling devices. I've also seen residues on tables and whatnot. And of course, testing the refill fluids directly on the cells is less expensive and less time consuming. And I think that's an important point when we have more than 8,000 unique flavors out there. This is a quick way to be able to screen these, find ones that are potentially harmful, and continue more in-depth experiments from there. So this is a very busy table. This came out of our lab in 2012. What I want you to just take notice of is the three categories. We screened 41 electronic cigarette refill fluid fluids and products across three separate cell lines, cell types, and we came to categorize them as non-cytotoxic, moderately cytotoxic, and highly cytotoxic. And of these 41 different flavors, we found that cinnamon Ceylon was the most cytotoxic to all three of these cell types. So we then had an interest in this, and just taking a peek here at the dose response data from an MTP assay, which tests for cell viability, this is just showing you the three cell types that were screened and the dose response curve with percent of control plotted as a function of dose and percentage. So then we were interested in cinnamon-flavored refill fluids. We thought, is there a general cytotoxic effect on cinnamon flavors, or you know, what's going on there? So we wanted to determine specifically if cinnamon-flavored electronic cigarette refill fluids are generally cytotoxic, and then identify possible toxicants within these flavors that may be harmful to users. And the details of this work are presented below at the link that you see here. So for the remainder of the talk, I'll be discussing two different cell types, human embryonic stem cells, which is our prenatal model for human development. Our lab has developed and utilized a specific protocol for using human embryonic stem cells, which are usually very difficult to work with, and we've become very proficient at using this cell type. And also human pulmonary fibroblasts, which of course is the organ most exposed to these products. So once we started using cinnamon Ceylon in experiments, one thing that was very clear is that cinnamon Ceylon is very volatile. And we wanted to devise a way to detect and eliminate any kind of vapor effect. And what I mean by vapor effect is in a 96-well plate, when cinnamon Ceylon is plated at the high dose, that it's transferring over to adjacent wells and causing adverse effects, not due to whatever we've treated in that well. So what we did was, let me get my pointer back. We have here a 96-well plate with cinnamon Ceylon plated at a high dose. Water is in the adjacent wells, and after 48 hours, what you can see is there's definite movement of vapor to the adjacent wells, and that is seen in both our 1% dose and our 0.3% dose. And these doses just represent how much of the refill fluid is diluted into culture medium. We then wanted to see this using the MTT assay and see if this vapor is in fact causing the effect. So what we did for each of our cell types is plate, again, cells in a cross pattern with cinnamon Ceylon at the central well. After 48 hours, run MTT assay and see if there's transfer. And for the 1% dose in both of the cell types, you can definitely see a transfer of vapor that has caused death in the cells adjacent to the central well. However, for the 0.3% dose, although we saw vapor transfer, this vapor did not seem to affect the cell viability for both cell types. So now we wanted to carry on and look at other cinnamon refill fluids and see if these had the similar impact. So here are our 8 other products, and in fact, we also had a duplicate sample of number 53, our Tasty Puff, that you'll see in later slides. So we began by screening these products in an iterative screen, and keeping in mind that these are volatile compounds that are within these refill fluids, we wanted to eliminate vapor effect again. So what we did for each cell type, the 8 refill fluids were screened at our 1% high dose. Any of them that did not have a vapor effect were plotted as viable dose response curves, and any that did have vapor effects were then rescreened at a 0.1% high dose, which is lower than our original. And then repeating the exact same thing, any that were not present in vapor effect were then plotted as dose response curves. Any that did pose a vapor effect would then be rescreened at, again, a lower high dose, our 0.01% high dose, until all of the refill fluids had viable dose response curves. And what we got from this is that human embryonic stem cells and human pulmonary fibroblasts are both sensitive to cinnamon-flavored refill fluids, and that there is a definite range in potency across these products. And where cinnamon Ceylon was our most cytotoxic product in our original lab screen, cinnamon Ceylon actually fell midway in potency across these 8 other additional products. We then were interested in which of these chemicals might be causing the cytotoxicity. So components of cinnamon Ceylon were identified via GCMS. We identified 3 compounds, cinnamaldehyde, 2-methoxycinnamaldehyde, and dipropylene glycol. A 4th chemical was also identified via HPLC analysis in the other cinnamon refill fluids. After screening authentic standards of each of these chemicals, we found that cinnamaldehyde and 2-methoxycinnamaldehyde were cytotoxic, highly cytotoxic to these cells. The IC50s are found in the boxes within the graphs, where we have percent of control plotted as dose as a function of dose in terms of molarity here. And you can see that, again, the HPF and the human embryonic stem cells are similarly sensitive. My figure actually is not showing up. Well, this would have been a lovely image of our 3D plots from our chromatograms from our HPLC analysis. And all I wanted to show you there was that each one has its own unique chromatographic signature. That's okay because I have the quantitative data here to show you each of these refill fluids and the three chemicals, cinnamaldehyde, 2-methoxycinnamaldehyde, and vanillin, and which of these contains what. As you can see, some of these refill fluid products contain vanillin, some contain 2-methoxycinnamaldehyde. However, all of them contain cinnamaldehyde, and that's not surprising as cinnamaldehyde is probably the most common cinnamon flavoring that's used at least in the food industry and probably in electronic cigarettes now. So we wanted to understand the relationship between cytotoxicity and any of them correlated to any of our chemicals that we identified. And once playing around with the data, we definitely found a definite pattern between cinnamaldehyde and IC50 data. Whereas cinnamaldehyde is increasing, the cytotoxicity is also increasing, or the IC50 is decreasing. And we see that for both of our cell types. So again, as cinnamaldehyde increases, IC50 decreases, meaning cytotoxicity is increasing. So I'd like to then conclude with just some sum up points. Vapor effects can readily occur with use of volatile chemicals like cinnamaldehyde and must be eliminated in 96-well plates. And I think this is one point that maybe a lot of people maybe miss, and it's definitely something of concern to avoid erroneous data. And human embryonic stem cells and human pulmonary fibroblasts were both similarly sensitive to cinnamon-flavored refill fluids and the identified flavorings. And all of these refill fluids have different chromatographic signatures. And as I said, cinnamon Ceylon was our most cytotoxic refill fluid in our initial screen, but we have found more volatile and more cytotoxic cinnamon flavors with this additional screen that we've done. And the 2 toxicants identified were cinnamaldehyde and 2-methoxycinnamaldehyde. And just as the last sum up point, as the concentration of cinnamaldehyde increased, cytotoxicity increased as well. And we hope that this work will be valuable to users who are concerned with which flavors may be problematic or harmful to them, as well as manufacturers who are trying to eliminate possible harm-causing products from the marketplace. And also that the use data will help to improve electronic cigarettes so that they may be a better alternative than conventional cigarettes. And this work is just a small speck, and it's the hope that the flavorings will begin to be tested and that future work in this field definitely needs to occur. And with that, I would like to acknowledge my PI, Dr. Prue Talbot, the Talbot Labettes that contributed to this work, Barbara Davis, Yuhan Vasundra, and Dr. Sabrina Lin, as well as all of our supporters, and especially the FDA CTP for this invitation and all the organizers for their help, and my PhD program, Cell Molecular and Developmental Biology at UCR. Thank you.
If the speakers can come up to the front for the panelists. And also Dr. Bhatnagar from the American Heart Association will also be joining this panel. We'll do clarifying questions and questions together, so please get your questions onto your card and pass them over. Okay, I have a question for the panel. What are the harmful or potentially harmful substances of concern in e-cigarettes and why?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I think that's been discussed thoroughly throughout the day, that we've seen situations where there are potentially harmful components that have been formed or thought to have been formed with the electronic cigarettes. Clearly, what the last presentation that Rachel presented is that there's consideration for some of the flavors as well. We need to look at that.
So, this is a very complicated question, but there are three or maybe four classes of compounds that are special concern. So, first is the carbonyls. As we saw that e-cigarettes, when you inhale them, then you generate carbonyls. And sometimes, although the carbonyl concentration is much lower, in some circumstances, could be like 1/4 or 1/8 of the regular cigarettes. And certainly, as the cigarette actually, as the content of nicotine and solution decreases in the cigarette, the carbonyl concentration increases, also increases voltage. And there is some indication that most of the effects of tobacco could be mediated by the reactive carbonyls present in conventional cigarette smoke. So at least they have one significant class of chemicals that's also present in conventional cigarettes, almost to the same level as in conventional cigarettes. The second class of chemicals is the presence of particles, not really chemicals, but particles, and we talked about the particles. A lot earlier in the afternoon, we said that they were, we don't know whether they are toxic or non-toxic, but in general, from what we understand, is that the particles that are smaller are more toxic. Now, these e-cigarette particles are not like ambient air particles. They are carbonaceous particles with metals. E-cigarette particles are supersaturated aerosols. But from the particle chemistry, we do not know enough to say whether or not or how the constituents effect. Maybe there is a deferent nerve that when stimulated gets these adverse reactions, and it doesn't matter what the particle is as long as it's the right size. And the composition may or may not matter in the end. So I think there is concern that these particles might contribute to toxicity. And the third thing, which everybody forgets, I think, in this conversation, but the reason we're all here, is nicotine. Nicotine is not an innocuous substance. It's highly vasoactive, increases blood pressure, increases adrenergic release, and could have long-term harmful effects. It's been approved by FDA to use in situations, for example, for replacement therapy, and that's fine, only in those situations. But we know that nicotine has very profound effects on the developing brains of mammals and humans. We know that addiction plays a role in development of, say, changes in appetite and metabolism. So it has all these profound effects that's very dangerous. So the whole idea that e-cigarettes are some sort of a harm reduction device, that we should be making regulations to make them easily accessible, could have very dangerous consequences.
And, you know, my fault, I should have had everyone go through and just say who they are. There's three speakers who I did say their name, and sir, I didn't do yours. So let's pretend I didn't start too early, and let's start at the end, and if you'll just introduce yourself and where you're from. And yes, please.
Again, I'm Robert Leverett from Lorillard Tobacco Company.
Shane Gadd, Gadd Consulting.
Arunee Bhatnagar from the University of Louisville and Director of the American Heart Association Tobacco Center.
Rachel Behar, University of California, Riverside.
And mostly I figured that would help the people that were online, too, because people in the room probably figured it out, but it'll help the people online. Dr. Leverett, why did you choose Marlboro as a test product or cigarette and snus compared to Blue e-cig?
We chose Marlboro because it is the market-leading cigarette in the United States, and that's the main reason why we chose Marlboro. And, of course, we chose Blue e-cigarettes because of, Blue e-cigs is owned by Lorillard, Inc., so.
Okay. All right. Do you have another? If you were to recommend a battery of in vitro tests for routine testing before and for regulatory purposes, e-cigarettes are placed on the market, what would they be? If you were to recommend a battery of in vitro tests for routine testing.
I'll take that one. And keep in mind that what you're, in vitro tests, the part we didn't get to, in vitro tests have their limitations. They are meant as a screen. And I think that's the way your questioner posed it, a way of screening out those things that, if you will, those that could go forward into, that didn't have an indication of a big effect, and those that you should drop. The aims would be number one, I think clearly, for mutagenicity. Certainly that's the FDA and ICH and ISO's position in terms of devices or drugs, and I think it's appropriate here. Cytotox properly done, but cytotox, if you've been in the device world for very long, cytotoxicity doesn't correlate really well with in vivo effects for all sorts of reasons. There's lots of publications on that. But if you wanted to screen out really bad actors, go for severe cytotoxicity and a concentration response curve, not just a single one, that gave you an idea, allowed you to tie into the relevance of what exposure in humans would be. Those two, and perhaps cytokine release for inflammation, maybe those three would be the ones that you could use well to screen out the things at the top level and not spend a huge amount of money, so you could screen a lot of compounds. I mean, going back to the first question you asked, I don't think we know, and there's the rub, I don't think we know enough about e-cigarettes in terms of what the exposure is, who uses them, all those other things, to say what the components of risk are. Clearly, the indication of some of the things we might add in terms of flavorants or otherwise should be done very carefully, but there's a lot of prior art on those kinds of things also. So it's a complex question. Okay.
So I would sort of agree with that. It has to be very careful for in vitro testing, and in particular I would add that sometimes that this could be completely misleading, particularly when you're trying to, for example, in this instance, trying to understand the effects of e-cigarettes or even conventional cigarettes. Suppose one of the things that e-cigarettes do is to cause increased cardiovascular disease risk. Now, you cannot model blood coagulation or blood pressure changes or cholesterol changes into a dish. So if you measure something and say, this is rather innocuous, you know, because in the dish it will come out to be clean, and whereas in real life it may have profound effects on blood pressure and coagulation. The second thing is how these things, how these experiments are done. If you're comparing, say, conventional tobacco cigarettes and e-cigarettes, and then e-cigarettes contain maybe some part of that toxicity is because of, say, carbonyls. When you make an extract, those carbonyls are gone. So whatever toxicity studies you do would not report anything, but that does not mean that e-cigarettes are less toxic or X amount of less toxic than conventional cigarettes. There couldn't be a sort of a comparison. Similarly, if you put particles, and if you take out particles from the moment you concentrate them or put them in a culture dish, you alter all their chemical and physical properties, so what you get is very little relevance to what they do in vivo. So the in vitro tests, though they might be easy and could in some instances be used, for example, in mutagenesis assays and so on, to get some idea, they could often be misleading and put you in the completely wrong direction, and you think that things that are non-toxic will turn out to be toxic, and things that you think is toxic may not be toxic at all. Over.
Well, I'm going to differ a little bit. I want to make clear that what I was suggesting, the way I answered the question, is those things you want to screen out as the puppies you send home. You look for severe toxicity. You cut down your population just as you would do for drugs, just as you would do for materials used in devices, or on and on and on. It doesn't mean that those things that go on are necessarily, essentially safe or safer. It just means they pass that first test. It also does not mean with certitude that those things that you screen out were necessarily bad. But they have a much higher probability, and screening is all about identifying probability sets. This set is probably, with the resources we can, if we've got to look at a lot of compounds, the resources we can put in is probably ones that we need to send the puppies home.
How significant is the potential for constituents of flavors, especially natural extracts, to elicit respiratory sensitization of e-cigarette users? So how significant is potential for constituents of flavors, especially natural extracts, to elicit respiratory sensitization?
So that varies with the patient population and specific sensitivity responses of individuals. So some people are very sensitive to, say, cinnamon, and some people can tolerate them well. So it depends upon, and these flavors are natural compounds that can stimulate very sensitively different allergic responses. So it varies from individual to individual. But things like cinnamon, it could be in general be sort of allergic response. Although it is, I mean, contrary to your experiments, well tolerated. Spice has been used for over several thousand years, and it's been there's been no remarkable toxicity. So, which kind of brings home again to the point that maybe sometimes the in vitro results will tell us something that's very different from the in vivo. So, if on the basis of we never use cinnamon, we do this experiment, we say cinnamon is really bad; it should never be allowed for human use. But it does in the end. You will have used it for 2,000 years. So we have to this in vitro stuff has to be balanced with some later in vivo studies.
This was talked about a lot earlier, but most of the chemical flavorings that are used, the only tox data is ingestion and not inhalation. So this is the important thing, is to try to get information toward the inhalation aspect. So cinnamon, of course, is used, and it's used widely throughout many different purposes, but it's generally eating and not inhalation or even dermal exposure. And I think both of which, cinnamaldehyde is an irritant.
You're going to have to use the microphone when every speaker, the people online.
I was thinking in the in vitro experiments, it was not inhalation, it was still cinnamon solution over cells. So that would be like ingestion.
Right. But our next step would be aerosol.
Let me direct back to the question that was asked, which was sensitization or an immune response, not just cytotoxicity. Very different. And it's a population of beasts. And I'm going to go ahead and use the Coombs and Gallus classification. Type 4, delayed contact sensitization, T-cell modulated, adaptive immune response, or type 1, which is immediate and mostly an innate immune response and could be life-threatening. Type 4, you get swelling, you get erythema, you get edema, you get the typical inflammation type of disorder. Type 1 is mast cell release of histamine and such, and leading in some cases to anaphylaxis and such. So the use of the term natural, by the way, natural ingredients, we use that as sort of, some people use it as sort of it makes it all good, it's a bomb. And, you know, strychnine is natural, arsenic is natural, maybe not, nicotine is natural. So you for type 4 sensitization, we actually have some very good QSAR models that allow us to look at the structure and say, yeah, this has the potential to either directly or by haptenization cause a type 4 response. Not so much for type 1. There we don't have anaphylaxis. We don't have particularly good models, except you could look at mast cell release of histamine.
Okay. Rachel, this was...
There is a high concern that some of these flavors could elicit allergic responses, and they need to be individually tested before use.
Rachel, coumarin is a known contaminant in some commercial cinnamon flavors, and it is also cytotoxic. Did you analyze the cinnamon flavors for coumarin?
No, only cinnamon Ceylon was run through GCMS. And then using that data and some other knowledge, that's how we generated the four compounds. So it's definitely worthwhile to go back to the additional refill fluids and identify any other compounds that might be present in them. So no.
Okay. Dr. Bhatnagar, there's a question about your statements about nicotine and the safety of nicotine and that it has been approved by the FDA in nicotine replacement products. So all the stuff that you were saying about nicotine, but it is approved for the nicotine replacement products. How do you reconcile that?
The nicotine that's been used for nicotine replacement therapy is only in patients who want to change from cigarettes to not to stop smoking, not for adults, teenagers with developing brains. And even in them, they would be harmful. The way the nicotine that's taken in gums, et cetera, is absorbed is much slower, and there isn't that spike, that instantaneous spike in blood that happens when you smoke a cigarette. Even e-cigarettes have a slow spike. So one of the reasons why cigarettes are so addictive is because of this big hit that you get right away, and that fuels the addiction, whereas there's less addiction on nicotine replacement therapies. So in low doses of nicotine by itself, it could be, it is not that toxic. Now, when nicotine is ingested or inhaled with other substances, for example, during smoking, that it could change the pharmacokinetics of nicotine, its absorption, its effects, and its metabolism. So that's why nicotine in cigarettes is so much, much more effective than it is by itself. And nicotine in say smokeless tobacco or tobacco products is also much more toxic and much more addictive than it is by itself. So the properties, the psychoactive properties of nicotine as well as vasoactive properties of nicotine are significantly modified by other constituents. And so within that context, it is much more both addictive and toxic.
Anybody else? Any other comments?
Dose makes the poison. What's your exposure? The whole risk assessment paradigm, don't lose sight of it. Identify potential hazards, okay? There's a potential, and everything has a potential, okay? Evaluate, in other words, get a dose response curve or a concentration response curve. What are, in fact, the dynamics in terms of amount of exposure? And then finally, relevance. What's the actual exposure, the part of... If people that smoke e-cigarettes of different forms or different ingredients, how much is the actual exposure going to be? So yes, there's a potential risk. Yes, we have essentially, if you will, a dose or concentration response curve. And yes, we know what human exposure is. So it's more complex. It really is that integrated approach you have to have through each parts. And one of any one of those by itself is rarely sufficient.
That's right. You probably need both.
And I will acknowledge that I am getting some other questions that have to do with harm reduction and what other countries are doing with that. That's getting a bit out of the toxicology realm, which I'd really like to stay with for this panel. So it was mentioned that the use of 3D culture systems increased relevancy. To date, these systems have not gained regulatory acceptance. So why should manufacturers invest the time and effort in this area?
Yes, it's true they haven't gained acceptance, but as a research tool and to gain a better understanding on the toxic impact that these products may have, they are an important tool. I know it's going to take time to get them to a level where they can be used at a higher level of, you know, regulatory decision or what have you. And, you know, they're just right now, they could be utilized as a tool to gain some understanding. And that's really all I can say at this point, because, I mean, we have very little experience with them in our own hands. However, we are, you know, going down that avenue looking at 3D cultures for use in our labs.
Anyone else want to address that?
The 3D cultures, again, bring us one step closer to reality, but still it doesn't simulate all the complexities of a multi-organ response, which is what happens in the effect of smoking, and that probably is the most important toxicological response, not just say a response on the in one particular, just the lung, or response in the blood, but it's just the combination of that. And so it doesn't simulate all that complexity, so it necessarily must be limited in its relevance.
Okay. What is the role of subchronic rodent inhalation toxicology? Subchronic rodent inhalation on toxicology.
Okay, well, I guess this one does fall to me. And the problem is that rodents are not, for smoking or for inhalation, aren't necessarily a particularly good model for man. The organism level response is good, but actually getting target organ exposure in a rodent that is an obligatory nose breather, it goes through a system of nares and fine bone separation because they're obligatory nose breathers. It's an adaptation. So that's great in terms of the nose, but humans don't smoke most of the time, I hope, through their noses. So it's unfortunate that, you know, rodents are preferred because they're inexpensive, and most people don't emote as well with a rodent as opposed to a larger organism. But if you can't, there are ways to get around the issue of the nasal protective barrier and obligatory nasal nose breathing, even in rodents. But it makes it much more difficult and more expensive. So. What's the advantage? If you can get the stuff past the nose and actually into an inhalation system in deep lungs, keeping in mind also that particle sizes or droplet sizes that are going to get into deep lungs or rodent are very different than those that get into a human, okay? But if you can get past those or somehow balance them out, and we believe we have for gases at least, okay, then it's a good way to, again, it's a better screen for toxicity as you'd see in man. But little mice, little rats are not little people.
So having done rodent inhalation toxicology for 20 years, I have to muster some defense. It is true. They're very different from humans. But in terms of exposure, inhalation toxicology, in several of the major human effects of exposure we can replicate in rodents. So, for example, we've done these studies with exposure to ambient air particles, and in ambient air particles there is In humans, you get increased, say, insulin resistance and heart disease and excuse me, atherosclerosis. And so that all of those effects we can replicate in rodents. There have been experiments in rodents with tobacco smoke. They've shown that rodent exposure increases atherosclerosis in rodents, and that changes blood pressure, changes lipids, and changes endothelial function. So all the major hallmarks of and cancer, all the major hallmarks of human pathology could be replicated in rodents. And so, therefore, they have some use. Of course, they don't breathe it like that. Thank you very much. They don't breathe like humans. So the type of study, the relevance of the studies for secondary exposure, for example, and inhaled ambient air exposures, the rodent models are much more relevant than direct mainstream exposure to tobacco smoke, but still they're very useful.
What are the strategies that can be used to demonstrate that any flavor ingredient added does not increase the inherent toxicity of the e-liquid? What strategies can be used to demonstrate that any flavor ingredient added does not increase the inherent toxicity of the e-liquid?
I'm going to direct you to the LSAR, the Life Science Research Organization volumes that were produced on additives, ingredients to tobaccos. Now goes back 10, 15 years. Most of the other people, unfortunately, that were there, I think there's still the chemist who was with Monsanto is still alive, but most everybody else has passed away at this point. But it's a very good set of volumes that directly looks at those questions. It was done as tobacco additives, cigarette additives, but it would certainly be relevant to how you would assess what the effects are and so forth for e-liquids.
Okay.
So that would be a guide, but the effect of adding these flavors to e-cigarettes could be completely different from the effect of flavors on conventional cigarettes. So I think then they need to be re-examined in their own context with, you know, propylene glycol and with nicotine and with heating rather than burning and doing other things. So the first of all, in order to do that, we need to identify a clear-cut index of harm of e-cigarettes, in which we, as far as I know, we have not identified as yet that this is a sort of a hallmark harm that if you smoke e-cigarettes, your whatever, something happens. Of course, your blood pressure goes up, your heart rate goes up, but that's a different thing. So if you use those parameters, which we do know, which may not be directly indicative of toxicity but some effect, or bioavailability, then you can test whether addition of any flavor would, A, change nicotine bioavailability, which would be an important consideration, or whether the flavors have de novo toxicity independent of nicotine, for which we need to establish what those might be. So I think there's some work needs to be done in establishing standards of toxicity before testing whether the flavor is going to be toxic or not.
Yeah. Any other comments? No. Do we have other questions that have come in from it? No other questions. Everybody's kind of winding down. No toxicity questions for e-cigarettes. Mache? Yes, sir. Do you want to go ahead?
I would say that even though I pointed out the limitations of the rodent inhalation model, I started with that 40 years ago, long before that, and back when it was all whole body, and then we went to head only, and then we went to endotracheal, so we tried to modify to get around those. If you remember what I said about the available data, the ascendancy of it, well-conducted inhalation studies are the best thing you have out of our available data, whether they're rodent or not. Now, give me my dream world, and my dream world is they're conducted with the technology we have available now. But, okay?
Okay, I have one more, and then I'll give the microphone. Maybe I'll walk around and do first, so you won't have to do the cards as we're closing up for the end of the day. What is the panel's view of in vitro testing for a product that's been effectively on the market since 2003 and today tolerant with smokers? What's the panel view on in vivo testing? for a product that has effectively been on the market since 2003, and it's tolerant with smokers.
Who decided it was tolerant? And maybe some people were tolerant, some people not. And maybe we have no long-term, or not long-term, but even short-term, well-powered studies to show that 2,000 people are smoking and all of them were tolerant and did not have any adverse effects. So the claim that it's well-tolerated, being on the market, does not necessarily make it a safe, acceptable product, and I think that's a very dangerous line of thinking. If we have, that's the reason we need these in vivo studies, both in animals and in humans, preclinical models as well as in humans, that whether or not these things are toxic and tolerated. Now, the other more complicated problem is that if e-cigarette users, generally everybody uses e-cigarette, the nice, healthy people who are just trying to, you know, do this for fun or trying to change, they may be less effective. There may be specific vulnerable population, for example, the elderly, the people with diabetes, people with asthma, you know, people with precancerous states, pregnant women. All of these subclasses of vulnerable populations may be very, very sensitive, which we just do not know about. So unless that we do all of these things in specific vulnerable populations and we understand even a general healthy female or a male how well tolerated this product is, we cannot claim that, or we cannot suggest there's no need to do any more further in vivo testing just because it's been widely used. Lots of things are widely used but are not safe and not acceptable.
Rachel, others?
We have clients from overseas who frequently will come to us and say, we don't have to do animal testing because we have done small clinical trials and they don't call them small clinical trials, and we haven't seen any issues. My answer is usually, and what did the necropsies show? And that's not really quite a joke. It's saying that you can't get, when you start to talk clinical trials for these products, you're making them something very different, okay? And you can't get the information. We're not going to necropsy. Would you like to volunteer for a clinical trial? By the way, at the end, we're going to euthanize you, and, well, no, we're not going to do that, okay? So our animal models have to stand in place of, or the data we already have in our animal models have to stand in place of, something that we might do for a drug where we had a much more measurable, it's a patient population, much more closely defined susceptibility of the population, a problem we have with testing new drugs. We tend to do our initial trials in normal volunteers, but they're not going to take the drug, and they don't really characterize what the risk may be. So we need to use the data that's reasonable to have or to generate in hand, at least in the broad spectrum.
Okay. I still think that we'll end early, a few minutes early, but Dr. Gonowitz, do you want to ask a question?
Just a quick question about the Lorillard study. In your study, you tested only two flavors. We're talking about the toxicity of the flavor, but blue are now available in the different flavors, like vanilla, cherry, etc. Do you have any data showing any differences between your product with the different flavor on the cytotoxicity and all these tests that you have done?
Currently, the extensive study we did was only on the Magnificent Menthol and the Classic Tobacco. We haven't put other flavors through the screening yet. You know, again, it's on the table to do it. So, but we didn't see any real differences between the Magnificent Menthol and the Classic Tobacco flavors that were used in this study, any effect on the cytotoxicity or the Ames assay with these flavors.
Okay, so do you know what? I have two more questions that came in. I think we'll still be able to get to your question, though. What is the relative cardiovascular harm caused by carbon monoxide versus nicotine in cigarettes?
So, the short question, we don't know. The So in tobacco smoke is a complex mixture, and carbon monoxide has been suggested to be one of the constituents that is actually going to form hemoglobin in the blood and prevent respiratory movement or respiratory activity. We're not particularly sure whether carbon monoxide is the major toxic constituent. I think it's a modifying feature that sort of contributes to overall toxicity. Nicotine is vasoactive and has effects on coagulation, blood pressure, and so on. But it's not sort of toxic by itself per se. So this problem, as we were talking about this in the afternoon, you put all these components separately, they may not be very toxic. But you put the whole thing together as a mixture, and then it becomes toxic. And that point becomes very difficult to tease out individual things and say this and this is toxic. But within the whole mixture, the more carbon monoxide you have, there'll be more toxicity, right? In conditions, like some things like hookahs, which have very, very high levels of carbon monoxide, could have more profound cardiovascular effects if used continuously to the same dose as conventional cigarettes. So it is a modifying feature. So CO, air, carbon monoxide, is a modifier of the toxicity of tobacco smoke. And we don't know if it's a contributor.
All right. Are there levels of toxicant considered acceptable in consumer products and medications that could be used as benchmarks or standards for developing appropriate standards for e-cigarettes? Go ahead.
Well, that's an interesting question. You heard today about GRAS. GRAS applies only to foods. We have all sorts of clients that come over the wall that it's GRAS, so we can use it in this drug, et cetera. You've got to decide what the becomes a very complex question. You've got to decide how well the population is informed of any potential risk. There is always some potential risk. It's how much, and is it acceptable? You notice when I talked about the device type testing, I said a qualified amount, and that would be an amount that, if we can set, this would be something that we have data to believe that it's in fact safe or of acceptable effect, and then we put on top of that a series of, we now call them uncertainty factors, we used to call them safety factors, we'll call them safety factors again in the future, everything is new again, okay? So for drugs, it's very different than it is for foods. That's why GRAS doesn't matter. For drugs, you have a benefit, one. Two, you have a learned intermediary, a physician, or some equivalent, who in fact intercedes in helping make that risk-benefit ratio and says, yes, there really is a benefit here. And you have the patient who has a real foreseeable benefit and has the information presented to them. Now, whether they totally cognate all of it, that's a different question. Whereas for foods, you don't. For foods, it's there, it's in the entire food system, or it's in a novel level in drinking waters. Okay? So, but the consumer doesn't really know. So where in that informed consumer spectrum would e-cigarettes fit in? That's part of the question that you have. That's part of your, that's the challenge. Identify those things that are unacceptable, that when we don't trust the consumer. There are drugs that are fit into that category also, even though they're well informed. Okay, drugs really fall into almost three categories. Those that you can buy, you get a prescription, you can go to the drugstore, and they're safe enough that we trust you if you walk away from there to take that medication, and you're not going to hurt yourself unless you really want to. Then there are those that have to be administered by a licensed practitioner, a home health nurse, or whatever. Okay? And then there are those that can only be done in the hospital. The cytotoxic cancer drugs, et cetera. Okay? Have to be done in the realm of a clinical establishment where something goes wrong. So the same is going to be true here. We're going to identify those things. If they fit into that last category, if an e-cigarette composition fits into that last category, it's not going to be allowed. You're not going to let people make that decision. You can't. Okay? But how, if they're that first category, they can buy it at the drugstore, wherever, okay, with adequate warning, then what's adequate warning? That's your question.
So, just sort of to elaborate on that, whether there's acceptable or non-acceptable risk is a moral, social question, not a scientific question. The scientific question is whether there is a threshold over which something is toxic and a threshold where it's not toxic. Okay, that assumes a non-linear dose response curve, which sometimes is true, sometimes not. If the dose response is linear, there is no non-toxic dose. In terms of e-cigarette, what can we expect? We know from our work, previous work on both tobacco exposure and air pollution, that the effect of tobacco and air pollution on at least cardiovascular mortality is non-linear. What that means is most of the risk is transmitted at very low concentration. So for example, exposure to two or three cigarettes would impart as much risk as smoking two packs a day, 80% of the risk as much as two packs a day. So if you say, okay, we have e-cigarettes, and e-cigarettes are 20% as harmful as normal cigarettes, but they still transmit 80% of the harm, right? And then if because people presume that e-cigarettes are safer, they smoke more because they can smoke intermittently, they can smoke at places where smoking was not allowed, so the total exposures increase, so that even though toxicologically they may be less harmful than normal cigarettes, as an individual as well as on a population basis, they might be equally harmful on an individual as well as a population basis. So just because we say in some cases they don't have these chemicals, that they are going to be less harmful and then we should advocate general use, could run into this problem and not really diminish any harm at all.
It occurs, there's one other thing to think about, and that is that with traditional tobacco products, with cigarettes and stuff, the lethality and the long-term health effects are largely around cardiovascular, pulmonary, number one, COPD, emphysema, et cetera, and cancer, okay, all of which are not acute effects. They're long-term exposure effects, and predicting those is one of the real challenges here. It's a challenge for drugs also. It's a challenge for everything. But okay.
Good point. Okay, it's almost 5 o'clock, which we said we were going to quit. So your last question, and the answers are what's between everybody being able to go or not. So
I promise it's going to be a really quick question. This is for Dr. Leverett. I just wanted to know, when you were doing all of your in vitro assays, did you test the fluid from different batches that were created? And if you did you see any difference in the effects?
The fluids that we tested, I mean, these were off-the-shelf products. The classic tobacco and the magnificent menthols, they were from the same lot. So to answer your question, no, we didn't see any differences because they were from the same lot.
Okay, thank you very, very much for both the session speakers and for the panel. Thank you to everyone for attending the first day. Tomorrow we will start at 8 o'clock in the morning. We will start with the public comment session. If you are a public comment speaker, I would suggest you're here early so that you're signed up and you're ready to go, because there's many, many public comment speakers. And I will keep everybody on time for that. So I will be giving instructions for that tomorrow morning. So be early. Thank you. Thank you very much.